You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 5th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. It is Matt and Mike Thursday today as Sam celebrates the Jewish New Year. Happy
Rosh Hashanah,
everybody. We tried to say that together. It didn't work as well as we thought. We were also discussing before we started the show that between Michael and I, there is one full Jewish person in the room because we are both half Jewish.
I may even be more than half Jew, actually. There's some not total clarity about that.
My family. Might be some extra Jew
maybe
in here.
Even more. But between us and Sam, obviously the bagel and lox people are very represented in this office.
Yes. I guess that doesn't bode well when we fight those conspiracy theorists about Jews controlling the media.
Yeah. Where's my Jew media control benefits? What the hell?
So happy New Year to all of our Jewish listeners, and we have a great show for you today.
And happy New Year to all you non-chosen people as well.
All right, thank you, Michael Bloomberg. Let's get to what we're talking about on today's show.
All right, we have a great show. We have Ali Gharib. He's a journalist, Middle East expert. We're going to run through the congressional hearings on Syria, what's happening right now. We're also just going to be talking about bad historical analogies and why comparing what's happening now in Syria, the vote on Syria, to a Munich moment is sort of a putz analogy to draw, if I'm going to continue on the Jewish theme. We also have new news from the TSA has a new strategy for
combating terrorists
and making travel a little bit more easy for
the rich.
Certain Americans.
Yes. We also have a story. We were going to follow up with that that flyer that was being passed around Portland, Oregon. And we'll be also following up with the congressman who saw physically fit people using foot stamps. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was disgusting. Also, Australia's prime minister gave about the most articulate and robust defense and articulation of why marriage equality is the right thing that I've certainly ever seen from a politician. So we're going to play some sound of that.
Also, a certain congressman, you lie, has a very interesting theory about why Obama wants to strike Syria. It's very, very thought-provoking, very well
thought out. It's the type of theory that would make you want to support striking Syria.
Speaking of Syria, we spoke yesterday about John McCain playing poker on his iPhone during the Syria debates. And we've pulled a very special song to give ode to John McCain. So let's go to that song while Michael calls our guest, and we will be right back.
We'll be right back with Ali Gharib. Enjoy this song, folks.
crazy game of poker.
Crazy game of poker.
I lost it all.
I lost it all.
But someday I'll be back again. And I never fall. Never fall.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. That was a crazy game of poker going out to
OAR.
And joining us now is Ali Gharib. He's an independent journalist covering the Middle East and national security. Ali, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. It's great to be with you guys.
Great to be talking with you.
Thanks for joining us.
So I want to kind of start off of the bat with this notion that John Kerry and other people have been kind of putting forward that basically the vote on Syria amounts to a Munich moment. And it's kind of shocking, I have to say, to watch this kind of resurgence of these large-scale, kind of industrial-grade World War II analogies only 10 years after they were deployed in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. And it's also disappointing to see people like Kerry, who you would think, in general, probably do have a bit more kind of sophisticated views of this stuff. What is to be gained by drawing that type of analogy, or is it just as kind of crude and stupid as it appears to be?
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of a sign of desperation on the part of the Obama administration in trying to convince Congress. You know, it's not their push for the vote is not going well for them. The two big whip counts I've seen out there, one from Think Progress and one from the Washington Post, don't really look great for the Obama administration. I mean, it's not a done deal, but it's still definitely up in the air, and they're kind of pulling out every trick in the bag to try and convince Congress to go for this intervention. One of the funniest things about the appeal to the World War II analogies, though, is that the Congress, the administration has been so insistent, and so have the many of the war's advocates, in print, it's advocates in the commentariat have been so insistent that that people who oppose the intervention shouldn't use analogies to Iraq or Afghanistan. And Obama even said in his press conference in Sweden the other day that this is not Iraq or Afghanistan. And so it's like those of us who are skeptical about intervention can't use these two recent conflicts that plunged our country into 10-year-long costly wars, but the administration itself can feel free to deploy these seriously overwrought analogies to the run-up to World War II and American and European involvement there. I mean, it's just sort of absurd.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it also runs counter and contradicts the second thread of this here, which is really, you know, they've been very unclear about, even Kerry got tripped up. I guess that's not necessarily surprising, but he got kind of tripped up on the question of whether or not there would actually be a U.S. troop presence in Syria. And then at the same time, in order to gain this congressional support that you're talking about acquiring, which is proving very difficult for them, they're definitely pushing the notion pretty strongly that this will be a limited engagement and mainly take place and only take place through airstrikes. At the same time, if this is World War II, and this is analogous to a Munich moment, wouldn't that mean that every available option, at the very least, would be, you know, at least seriously considered and pursued? So I guess even on the level of, like, what are they trying to communicate through that about what the actual stakes are here?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it just sort of smacks of desperation. Yeah. I don't think that they're serious with that analogy. And as you point out, they can't be, because if this is the Munich moment, then yeah, you know, the whole point of the Munich moment was that this whole meme about appeasement, which doesn't quite get the history right and doesn't understand the context of the Munich Agreement, which, you know, I agree failed miserably, but this whole meme of appeasement.
What happened
by
at
Warhawks,
Munich, Ali? No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, Matt Thus pointed out in his column that the whole Munich thing has gotten has become such a common meme in hawkish talking points that it sort of lost all historical context. And, you know, you pointed to that that Chris Matthews interview you were just making reference to during the campaign, during the 08 campaign, when Matthews interviewed this right-wing radio host and kept saying, what happened in Munich? And the right-wing radio host just said, it was appeasement, and clearly had no idea what the actual contours of the Munich agreement were.
Right.
And you know, that's gotten totally, totally lost here. And it's just become kind of sort of a buzzword. And, you know, when you have to resort to buzzwords in order to press a case for military action, like, you're not making a very strong case.
What do you think the closest analogy is? Is it Iraq, or is it Bosnia? Or is it not helpful to make an analogy like this to begin with?
Well, you know, the thing is that there's no analogy that fits perfectly the current situation. But the problem with saying that we can't use analogies at all is that it discounts the fact that any past interventions might have lessons to look at before this intervention. And so I think it's kind of a piecemeal thing about which lessons from which past interventions you want to apply. You know, Michael O'Hanlon, who's a pundit at the Brookings Institute, who I really don't agree with, he's a military analyst. I agree with him on very little. I applaud him because, you know, all these people are making the Kosovo analogy, and Michael O'Hanlon a few months ago made that analogy as a pro-war argument in the pages of the USA Today. And he said that setting up this kind of no-fly zone will require, as it did in Kosovo, somewhere around 20,000 boots on the ground.
Right.
And so that at least is like, you know, employing the analogy and saying that, look, you know, for him the lesson was different than it would be for me, because he's saying, obviously it's a pro-intervention argument, and I am quite skeptical about it, but at least he's making an intellectually honest analogy, and I applaud him for that. We should be looking at other situations and what happened and what worked and what didn't. And especially, you know, the comparison I always draw with Iraq is that we need to have a view of what our capabilities are and what our objectives are for those capabilities to accomplish. And perhaps most importantly, and this is one that I think that, you know, your comment about how Kerry opened the door to boots on the ground really speaks to this, is that one of the lessons of Iraq was that you can't just make these open-ended military engagements, and that you need to have some kind of exit strategy or off-ramp for the U.S. before it gets involved. And, you know, war doesn't always go to plan. In fact, it rarely does. But that doesn't mean that critics of intervention should be given a free pass in offering up at least some idea of how we're going to get into this situation and extricate ourselves from it. And that was the lesson of Iraq and Afghanistan, these two wars that we spent a decade in.
Absolutely. So moving beyond the sort of never-ending resilience, it seems, of kind of disingenuous arguments for foreign intervention in Washington, it seems to me that there's kind of two tracks for examining a strike on Syria, and it seems to come down in two ways. One is that the more minimal or smaller option, what type of impact could that really have in terms of fundamentally altering the dynamics of what's happening there? And then the second argument, and these are both efficacy arguments, would be that, you know, the type of broader engagement that it might take to really change an outcome there could lead to all of these really serious side consequences and unplanned scenarios that you were highlighting. Is that the kind of basic problem with going into Syria?
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting to watch the congressional back and forth with the administration about this, because the administration offered a draft authorization for the use of military force to the Congress that was quite open-ended and left open the possibilities to even a potentially really broad, unlimited time frame intervention to deter Assad from using chemical weapons. And then the Congress returned one that was much more limited in scope and, you know, basically was very careful only to authorize these initial limited strikes.
Right.
And then Kerry kind of conceded yesterday that look, if you guys want to just authorize a limited thing and we need to come back to you for further steps, that's okay by us. And it's been, you know, this is why it was so important for Obama to go to Congress on this. You know, I don't think he went necessarily out of fealty to the Constitution, which presents its own problems, considering that he's a constitutional scholar. But I think he moved to the Congress because the UK had taken its vote to not participate in the intervention. And as a result, that left Obama with his only allies as France and Turkey that were vocally backing a U.S. intervention. And even the Arab countries, Saudi Arabia and its Gulf allies and the GCC and the Arab League, would not make public statements in support of a U.S. intervention. They were just too cautious about it, probably perceiving that their publics would think that they were that vocally backing a U.S. intervention in the Middle East was kind of unsavory. And so, you know, and NATO itself said that it would not participate in this intervention. And so there was basically zero international or domestic legitimacy to a strike. And I think it was that situation that led Obama to Congress. That said, I think it was a really good decision exactly because it's exposed these sort of debates. We're actually getting lots of detail that we didn't previously have, even in the unclassified sessions, about what the administration's plan is, how robustly it plans to intervene there, and what it plans to do in the aftermath, what it hopes to accomplish. These are all things that we've only heard the administration speak directly to in detail since it decided to go to Congress. And so I think that just shows the value of this decision.
Yeah, and it also, incidentally, even though it will go through, or maybe already has, but it also prompted France to actually take a vote in Parliament on this action as well. And that's not likely to be a problem passing there, but I think you're right. It definitely, starting with the UK, it's been a much more open debate. Do you think at this point that with Kerry kind of backing down, well, actually, let me back up for a moment. It kind of opens up two different questions. So one is with Kerry backing down, and now you see Nancy Pelosi this morning sending a letter to Democrats in Congress. There's a lot of work now on, it seems to me, what do you guys need, basically? How narrowly written does this need to be? How cautious is approach does this need to be to still get your vote and go through? So it seems like, are we moving to a phase now where this is turning from, at least from a Democratic congressional point of view, and maybe also a Republican one, obviously coming from a different angle, from a real security, human rights decision, whatever way you want to frame it, to a political question for the Obama administration? Like, if we vote this down, if Democrats vote against this, this will be a huge embarrassment. If this doesn't go through Congress, so we need to ameliorate those conditions as much as we can, get something through, maybe take limited action, but we're already on to the question of political fallout and outside of what it is the administration may or may not be trying to do in Syria?
I think sadly Washington is a deeply partisan place, and there's always been kind of this BS line about how foreign policy is a bipartisan venture, and that's never really been true, and it's becoming even less true. But I think that would be a miscalculation that by members of Congress to view this as a political question. You know, David Cameron's government was certainly embarrassed by its vote in the parliament. But it wasn't brought down by this, and neither will be the Obama administration. Now, one of the most consistent things about U.S. foreign policy has been that we are inconsistent. I don't think it makes or breaks the Obama administration or its legacy or anything like that. But it certainly would be a little embarrassing, I think.
Yeah, and then is that kind of part of the calculus? Is the calculus shifting for them in that sense? That the planning on the administration's part maybe is turning into a how do we just not embarrass ourselves in Congress now as the kind of preeminent focus?
I think it has been to an extent the way you've seen Kerry, you know, being willing to accept Congress's changes to the authorization for the use of force, and as I said before, compromise on things like saying, listen, if you guys need us to come back to you for more authorizations, that's cool, just give us this one. But, you know, there might be political motivations on the parts of the Democrats who are taking part in that process so as to, you know, give the Obama administration something just to not be embarrassed. But at the same time, this is kind of how the process is supposed to work, right? And it is in Congress, and it is a political process, no matter what people say about foreign policy. And so I think it's good that there's compromise between these two co-equal branches of government. And, yeah, you know, the motivations might not be that great, but the effect is still that it fits with our country's modus operandi of being democracy, a representative democracy, and that's how these things are supposed to work. So I'm not that troubled by it, to be honest.
No, absolutely. And one would imagine that there would be a variety of policy areas that if there was more actual scrutiny and debate, the policy formulation would probably be better. Actually, I want to get to this notion. You kind of that line about the only consistency in foreign and on U.S. foreign policy being inconsistency. This rhetoric, I think Matt Duss, who was on the program yesterday, distinguished between these kind of two prime arguments for attacking Syria. And one, the stronger one, obviously, being that, of course, this is a really catastrophic human rights situation. The use of chemical weapons is a significant violation of international norms. And there's something to those arguments. On the other hand, this kind of our reputation, showing inconsistency, showing signs of weakness, this type of thing that you constantly hear regurgitated on cable news and particularly in
credibility,
right, excuse me, that's the word, credibility. Now, that seems intuitively like, I mean, to be polite, just an incredibly crude way of approaching policy. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that and also highlight, is there some recent actual research coming from political science literature that really casts doubt on this whole credibility approach to foreign policy making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of scholars, especially those kind of from what's called the realist school of foreign policy, have written about this recently. And yeah, the political science literature does not bear out that credibility has any real effect on how nations, especially in around the world, perceive us. They don't, you know, like I said, they know. The Iranians don't need a lesson that the U.S. can be inconsistent in its strategy and that it might not bomb Bashar Assad for gassing 1,000 people with sarin, but it might still bomb Iran if it's discovered that Iran is going forward with production of a nuclear weapon.
Under Bush, we might have bombed Cyprus for what Assad is doing. I'm just kidding.
I mean, it just goes. It just, you know, like you can look at Egypt today and see that there just is no consistency in U.S. foreign policy. And you know, I agree with a lot of the critics that have said that Obama has shown to have no grander strategy in Syria beyond maybe trying to not get involved, deeply involved. Seems to be his only strategy, and I think that that's a legitimate criticism. You know, I think there's some value in a strategy of not wanting to get deeply involved, but I agree that there is an absence of a proactive strategy there. But that said, it's not, you know, that doesn't exclude us from getting involved anywhere else down the line. It's just not, that's not how the U.S. government has ever operated, and that's true whether it's in the Obama administration or in other administrations. You know, you can see Bush's so-called freedom agenda fell apart on its own merits because of policies undertaken by the Bush administration.
Right.
You know, his effort to have a coup to overthrow the democratic government in Palestine because he didn't like the anti-Israel militant group Hamas. The way that Bush, you know, acquiesced to Hosni Mubarak's crackdown on democracy groups in 2005 and 2006. There's just remarkable inconsistency throughout American foreign policy. And, you know, any decently smart observer of U.S. foreign policy abroad will understand this and know this. And, you know, it doesn't matter what, you know, pundits in the pages of the Washington Post editorial board and the Wall Street Journal opinion pages say about it. It just doesn't matter that much.
Right. I think that probably can't be underscored enough. Related to this credibility argument is the administration's use and the focus on Iran, that the subtext of this is that we need to take action here to show Iran we mean business. And, you know, very, very kind of familiar rhetoric from the Iran playbook in Washington. Now, it strikes me that this is happening simultaneously as you have a new president in Iran who certainly has a far more kind of rational, moderate approach than his predecessor. More importantly, at this moment, Iran's supreme leader is signing off, apparently, on Rouhani's more moderate approach. You have a foreign minister in Iran who is going to play a much larger role in the nuclear negotiations, who has worked closely with the West and America in the past, specifically with Afghanistan. So it seems like just at this time that this kind of constant trope of we need to do this to get at Iran, there actually is some potential signals from Iran that this might be one of the best opportunities we've had in a while to potentially do something different.
To be fair, I wonder how many of them even realize that Ahmadinejad isn't the leader of Iran anymore.
Well, maybe not a lot of the people on Twitter. Pamela Geller actually thinks that Rouhani is Ahmadinejad's body double. So she's got a whole and they're both related to Malcolm X. But anyways, go ahead, Ali.
Yeah, I mean, look, you're right. There's this opening with Iran, and you know what? A lot of the Iran hawks, you know, they constantly harp on the fact that Ali Khamenei, Iran's unelected supreme leader, has final say on all matters of state, and that's true. But it is not a total dictatorship by Ali Khamenei. There are different political currents, and they can be influential on policy. And you know, judging from the results of the 2009 election, which lots of people, myself included, believe was a widespread fraud to keep Ahmadinejad in office and to keep the reformers and moderates out. You know, judging by that, when you look at Rouhani's victory, especially given the campaign platform that he ran on of moderation and specifically transparency in the nuclear program and wanting to ease sanctions to ease Iran's economic woes, it's clear that the supreme leader has at least opened the door to these currents being policy. You know, if it were an absolute dictatorship and he didn't want any transparency on any of this stuff, he would have never let this guy win.
Right.
And it shows that there are the politics of Iran do matter. Now, Rouhani is in a precarious position because Iran's parliament and its many factions of its Byzantine power structures are hardliners. They're people that don't believe in Rouhani's policy of moderation. And so he's in a place where he's trying to bolster this view to give some legitimacy to, you know, what many observers, including myself, think will be a bid for a diplomacy to strike a deal with the U.S. Now, a U.S. intervention in Syria certainly makes that more difficult, because the hardliners are sure to attack Rouhani and saying, listen, you want to talk to these guys, and they're going in and attacking our ally in Syria. And that will give Rouhani a political headache that stands to potentially weaken him within Iran's power structures. That said, I think that we should sort of judge intervention. Of course we should consider factors like this, but we can't make decisions based just on the politics of foreign countries. You know, we have to decide what's going on for America here and make our decisions based on that, but it's certainly a consideration of what it'll do to diplomacy with Iran. And in the sense that it might give hardliners a line of attack against Rouhani, even a limited strike against Syria could be bad for the prospects for diplomacy with Iran. However, if America were to get more entangled in Syria into a more robust intervention, and into having to do this repeated cat and mouse thing with striking chemical weapons, you know, say if the U.S. does undertake these limited strikes and then Bashar Assad again uses chemical weapons and the U.S. feels compelled to act again, starts feeding weapons to the opposition, sets up a no-fly zone, all those kinds of things, a more robust intervention by the U.S. will actually make it more difficult to attack Iran because, you know, as we learned over the past decade, being involved in two wars simultaneously, even in relatively limited foreign wars, is not an easy thing to do. And I think that the American public will probably be well aware of those potential costs of launching a second war if we're already in an ongoing war with Syria. And so I think it's a real, you know, what the most sort of ardent of the Syria hawks are pushing, and they are pushing this as having to send a message to Iran and, you know, it's Iran's ally, Bashar Assad. They're pushing that very hard, but the robust intervention they call for, I think, will, unbeknownst to them, actually make it more difficult, if it comes down to it, for the U.S. to attack Iran.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, I think that it's, you know, it's obviously judging it by our interests first and foremost, but I think ultimately our interests in that region, if it could be, and across the world, if it could be pulled off, the possibility of having a different type, more normalized relationship with Iran would have many intrinsic and ancillary benefits that would precisely benefit a situation like the one going on in Syria.
No doubt.
Yeah. So as a kind of a final sort of broad wrap-up question, you were saying earlier that you do think that a more proactive approach could be argued for. I know that I think this is another, parenthetically, this is another very important distinction to bring up. There isn't action and no action, and the only action is military. There's many other paths of action to at least attempt to do something about the situation in Syria. So what would, in the Ali Gharib view, be? What would be the smartest path of action moving forward with regards to Syria?
Well, you know, I mean, look, diplomacy has not worked out very well, but we're getting indications from even the Iranians that they would be willing to push some sort of diplomacy on Syria. It may not accomplish, you know, Obama's stated goal of Assad being removed from power, but it could at least staunch some of the bloodletting. I think that's definitely an avenue worth pursuing. Most urgently, Syria is the worst refugee crisis in the world right now, and a lot more needs to be undertaken by the U.S. and its regional allies in order to do that. Right now, our allies in Turkey and Jordan are bearing the brunt of the Syrian refugee problem. And you know, I think it was funny. There was this, Kerry said that the Gulf Arab regimes, you know, Saudi Arabia and the GCC allies and the Emirates and so on, have offered to pay for U.S. airstrikes, a limited intervention in Syria. And like, these guys should take their billions of dollars and pour it into the UN Refugee Agency,
right,
which has only come up with 40% of the budget it feels it needs,
right,
to address this refugee problem. I mean, this is like a humanitarian catastrophe and one that can be addressed with adequate funding. And, you know, of course, it's not going to end until the war there ends, which there's not many prospects of happening anytime soon, but it can certainly be ameliorated with the help of groups like the UN Refugee Agency and support of other regional actors, especially those that are incredibly flush with cash. And so I think that those are the sort of steps that, you know, whether or not we undertake this intervention, we need to engage heavily in the diplomatic process and on the refugee problem. And, you know, I think we got to disabuse ourselves of the notion that doing something like pouring in weapons into the hands of even vetted members of the opposition is a humanitarian intervention. It's neither here nor there when it comes to humanitarianism to give guns to one side or the other of a civil war. You know, that's only a recipe for more violence. And I'm not saying that it's unjust, certainly, for rebels to fight against Assad's government, which is really a morally catastrophic regime in and of itself. But that is not a humanitarian intervention.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, flooding Syria with weapons is not a humanitarian intervention necessarily, and address the crisis and refugees immediately. Ali Gharib, he's an independent journalist covering the Middle East, national security, foreign policy. Thanks so much for joining us on the Majority Report.
It's my pleasure.
All right, take care, man. Talk to you soon.
Okay, take it easy. Have a good one.
All right, bye-bye. Wow.
It's just not an easy situation. But I think Ali made a great point right there that, you know, this is not what needs to be done. I mean, there's other ways to help the Syrian people.
I mean, I think that the first and foremost thing, getting funding and helping with the refugee crisis, is the most pressing humanitarian and, in some respects, security thing to do. And I think that there's also just this – that's a big problem that we need to figure out, that this notion that there's doing nothing and then there's doing something, which is the military option. That's a totally false choice.
And there's no in-between to
there's
our,
no in-between.
Yeah.
There's no creativity. There's no saying. I mean, the notion of saying to the Gulf states, kick some money to the refugee agencies. Let these kids, you know, I mean, and it truly is a catastrophic situation.
And, you know,
you have people in the refugee camps getting recruited by rebels, teenagers, to go out of the refugee camps, go back into Syria and fight, which then makes them vulnerable possibly to attacks as well. I agree a lot with what Ali was saying about where to actually start in terms of the most press. If it's about human needs, then you got to address the most pressing human needs. Yeah.
I mean, I'm reading stories just in the past few days of, you know, people saying that we should be cutting aid to the Egyptian to Egypt because of the money was going to the Egyptian military.
Mm.
And I mean, you'd think, you know, somewhere along the lines with this talk about cutting foreign aid from a country that we're giving this aid to and that's being used for the wrong purposes. I mean, you think some creativity would be sparked just from that, you know, maybe we should give some of this aid, we should be extending foreign aid to these Syrian refugees and helping.
A lot more money to be good. But I mean, you know, that was a whole subtext of the invasion of Iraq, you know, which was obviously completely catastrophically stupid and the wrong thing to do. There was a huge refugee crisis that was created out of that. And that's still one of the subtexts of the war, along with the kind of massive privatization schemes and stripping off Iraqi assets. You know, but
according
but anyway,
to according yeah. to Think Progress, as of right now, 12:42 p.m. Thursday, September 5th, 2013, the latest Syria whip count is no or leaning no is at 199, and yes or leaning yes is at 49. So, I mean,
that's going to be very interesting to see if this goes through. But I think that those are the types of questions that you would like to really see in Congress, is not, yes, things have to be done. So let's talk about refugees. Let's talk about, you know, the myriad of issues connected to this. And, you know, I actually saw a clip of Chris Hayes last night, and he was saying that sometimes he drew the analogy to the American Civil War, and he said, you know, which was, there wasn't a use of chemical weapons, but I mean, what an incredible body count. What a horrifying thing. And, you know, in that war, you know, nobody's perfect, but obviously there was a side that was obviously better than the other side. Mm-hmm. One side, thank God, won. And, you know, it in some respects, I mean, basically Hayes was kind of saying it needed to work itself out. It needed to go to the end. And, I mean, I don't know if I would want to, you know, actually take that position on fully, but I think there is this element where, too, even with the Kosovo analogy, whether you're using it honestly or not, that wasn't a civil war. That was helping to get rid of an occupying force that was engaging in ethnic cleansing. Now, Assad is engaging in every number of war crimes imaginable, but it's a civil war, and he represents a real, you know, with Gaddafi, once you got to the rid of that inner ring around him, there was nothing left. Nobody liked the guy. In Syria, there's a network of support, which is why it's a genuine civil war.
With Gaddafi, too, there was a large international support there, too, as well.
And part of the reason, I think, for that was because this was not – there was no – I mean, even Gaddafi had to hire mercenary fighters from neighboring countries to be part of his fighting force. Like, there was no real base of broader support in Libya for Gaddafi outside of people very much within his networks. Whereas with Assad, there is a broader base of support. And that's why, you know, it's a civil war. And it just brings it, you know, I mean, you know, the last thing I would just note is it just throws all these other questions into place. Like the fact that Syria is still paying the consequences of colonially drawn borders that have nothing to do with it. You know, the Kurds, you know, there's this piece of these Kurdish woman fighters who are fighting. They oppose Assad. And now in the north, which is where the al-Qaeda fighters are most active, these woman fighters are fighting al-Qaeda fighters. And they said, Assad wants to repress us. These people want to annihilate us. They have to face a double bind. So then that implicates Turkey. Why can't Turkey get real, you know, improve on Kurdish human rights?
You know,
there's all of these broader questions to play that nobody wants to get into. They just want to shoot Tomahawk missiles, and that's not going to solve it.
The story about the Kurdish woman you brought up, I think that's really important, too, because You even hear, you know, Kerry's out there, all these Obama, all these politicians are out there, and they consistently use, and not just for Syria, for every issue like this, even domestic issues where they want to draw a line. There's the good guys and the bad guys, and it's not like that. There's gray area. There's people out there who aren't on either side, who aren't bad guys, who may necessarily not be good guys, and everything in between.
There's a lot of complexity, and you know, dropping a bunch of Tomahawk missiles in the midst of complexity isn't always such a hot idea. So, do we have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song?
I looked. I think that was just a classic Reefer Cake song.
Oh, okay.
If we have time, we'll play it, but we're cutting it short.
All right, then
what do you got?
I'll get to these stories really quickly, and then we'll go right to the bitter half. So, first of all, folks, when you go through the TSA...
Ah, this story.
If you're like me... It's so ridiculous because what other area of your life do you're walking on a linoleum floor and you're surrounded by strangers and you just start stripping on that floor? You take your shoes off, you take your belts off, everything. And then there are these people.
And it's the normal thing to do.
It's the normal thing
to do. It's not like you're like, whoa, what's that guy doing over there?
No. In fact, if you kept your clothes on, it would be like, what's that guy doing over there? And then people come to you, and I'm not into demonizing everybody that works at the TSA. Obviously, there needs to be a TSA. There's a lot of great people doing really important work. But at the same time, they come to you. They handle you. They throw out your drink. And every other day, there's a new, like, ridiculous rule about, you know, I remember when the toothpaste thing came in. I was flying internationally, and it was like, you can't. Yeah, that's an open cap on a toothpaste. That cannot happen. That's so.
If you're Ted Nugent's wife, you can't bring a loaded pistol to the airport.
I'm with the TSA on that one. But the point, and it's probably struck many of us that maybe all of these like random TSA, you know, maybe they're not all entirely on the up and up. Maybe they're, you know, weird things to keep people busy. Maybe they're, you know, random expansion of ways of bothering travelers that probably don't have much of a security benefit, frankly.
But on the other side, too, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who defend the TSA and think, you know, they have to check people because America and 9/11 and security and safety.
And I'm probably more one of those people than you. Okay,
But I mean, at least, you know, they
at least they have, and they say, you know what, and everybody has to go through these security measures, and that's the point. And
that's
this
just
is
life
big,
of that's just life in 2000 in the year 2000.
That's just life in the 21st century, yes. In the age of terrorism. Well, the TSA has announced that they will be accepting, that they will be creating a new program where travelers who will be willing to pay a fee can have their basic rights established, reestablished at airports to them.
Sweet. You can pay for your rights back?
You can pay for your rights back.
How much is
TSA.
That? How much does it cost? What?
$5? For a reasonable fee of $85.
$85?
The TSA will allow travelers to verify their identities and provide fingerprints at an enrollment center that will allow them to skip the long, stressful lines at security checkpoints. It's like the TSA was like, you know how airlines do this amazing thing where people who travel coach are treated horribly and with utter disrespect, and they're boarded last, and they have to wait in lines forever, and they sit on uncomfortable cushions, and then they get loaded in, and they don't have any food because we're cutting down even on like bags of peanuts, where like if Seinfeld was at the beginning of his career, he wouldn't have a career because he wouldn't be able to bitch about airport food because there's none of it anymore. Yeah, you know how they do all of that? Why don't we, as a government government-funded agency, why don't we just, you know, do the same thing? I mean, we're making a killing off of student loans. Why can't we introduce the class system to the airport screening? And, of course, it goes without saying that nobody who wants to do any harm on an airport, whether they're a terrorist or whether they're a moron like Ted Nugent's wife. People with money don't do stupid things like try to take down planes or, you know, bring a loaded gun onto an airplane. Doesn't happen.
We all know Osama bin Laden was super poor.
Yeah, Osama bin Laden was one of these poor brown guys that are causing all of the
problems.
How
much was his family worth?
They were in the billions, but that's not the point. That's not the point. Doesn't count if you're Muslim or something. Anyways, look, yeah, like, it's like if Osama bin Laden is just like, hey, I'd love, you mentioned some terrorists, I'd love to take advantage of this new pre-enrollment plan.
But still got 85 bucks.
$85, that is